This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, who are the Rohingya and why are they under siege? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. A wave of migrants from Bangladesh and Myanmar, formerly known as Burma, took to the seas seeking to escape poverty and, in the case of the ethnic Rohingya, religious persecution. The Rohingya are a stateless Muslim people who have long faced discrimination and have been deprived of basic rights in Myanmar. The government in Myanmar does not even recognize them as citizens and has refused to accept any back. However, in addition to the mistreatment at the hands of the predominantly Buddhist Myanmar, a new report by the U.S. Institute of Peace says that a humanitarian solution to the desperate boat migration of the Rohingya, which has claimed nearly 1,000 lives at sea and the same number again from abuse by traffickers and smugglers, can only be achieved through a holistic international approach. Well, for more on the underlying factors that led to the crisis and what can be done to ease the plight of the Rohingya, we turn to two distinguished analysts. John Sifton is the Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch. Previously, he was the director of One World Research, a public interest research and investigation firm. And Ms. Priscilla Clapp. She is retired minister counselor in the U.S. Foreign Service. Among her distinguished positions, she was Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Refugee Programs and Chief of Mission at the U.S. Embassy in Burma. Currently, Ms. Clapp is a senior advisor to the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Asia Society. And both panelists join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both. Priscilla Clapp, let me begin with you. First, let's define who are the Rohingya and why are they so discriminated against in Myanmar?
You have to go back to the British colonial period. Burma, as the British called it in those days, was part of the Raj, part of the Indian colony, up until the end of World War II. And during that period, the British engineered new borders in several places, as we know. One of the borders that they engineered was the one between Bangladesh and Burma. And the Rohingya group, which were living in that area, were split, in effect, between the two countries. So they've been residents of the country called Burma since the time that, let's say, the British drew that border. The colonial period has a very bad memory for Burmese, particularly for the majority Burmese who are Bama. They are Buddhist. And during the colonial period, the British brought many Indians and others in from South Asia, Hindu, Muslim, to run the government, to run the businesses, and the Bama felt displaced politically and economically. It created a long-term sense of resentment against the Muslim population in particular, although there's also a fairly large Hindu population in Burma. So this goes way back. The Rohingya are one subset of that. The Rakhine ethnic minority is also Buddhist and very similar to Bama. So the Rakhine themselves have integrated into the ruling class in the country fairly well once they've become educated. But those who didn't become educated stayed behind in the Rakhine state, became very, very poor, and were sort of competing for resources with this very poor Muslim group, the Rohingya. There are also several other Muslim sects in the Rakhine state who have been subject to the communal violence we've seen in the last few years. It's a mistake to call them all Rohingya. At any rate, because of their isolation, the Rohingya have remained very backward and very poor and definitely discriminated against. Some of them have citizenship. Most of them don't. They were carrying a kind of white card, which is similar to our green card. In the first elections in 2010, when this new government, the one that's in power now, came about, the big military government party had an interest in creating as many voters as possible for their party. So they invited all of the white cards and the Rohingya, everybody in that area, to vote. So they got a kind of status. Some of them were even elected to the parliament. During this period, there's been quite a lot of political reform, and most of the restrictions that the military government had on the people politically have been eased. It has led to a lot of social conflict. This is not unusual for a developing country that has been kept under repression for decades and decades. They don't really know how to deal with each other because they've never had to. And so there's a lot of social tension. One of the areas of social tension that developed was between the Rakhine and the Rohingya. And it was over essentially economic status. And in the 90s, there was an outbreak, and a couple hundred thousand of them fled into Bangladesh for safety. They were systematically repatriated by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees into Burma with the consent of the Burmese government. Most of them were brought back, and they were kept in an enclave that was attended to by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and the international community. In fact, the U.S. government has put a lot of money into that. These people were given all sorts of assistance and resettlement aid, but they were never able to regularize their status. And so the assistance program just continued and continued. The Rakhine, the poor Rakhine, particularly uneducated, unemployed youth, began fomenting about all of the international assistance to the Rohingya. Why couldn't they get something too? And they turned on both the Rohingya and the international assistance agencies. So it's been a very nasty situation in the Rakhine state. It's very unstable. It's dangerous for the Rohingya living there. But that is the fault, basically, of the Rakhine population there.
And that is one of the reasons the Rohingya have taken to the seas to escape this persecution.
That is part of it. Some of it is because there aren't jobs.
All right. Let me turn to John Sifton. That was an excellent background that Priscilla gave us with respect to who the Rohingya are, why, you know, they are in the situation they are. I'd like you to comment as well why, after so many years, notwithstanding the British colonial divide-and-conquer type of behavior, where they marginalized many of the indigenous Burmese and so forth and put Muslims and others in business and political positions. But now we're looking at a new Burma. Why the continued virulent anti-Muslim sentiment on behalf of the Rakhines and the fact that the Rohingya cannot regularize their status or become citizens?
We're in a new era of ethnic hatred against the Rohingya. The roots of the current crisis are in 2012, when violence broke out in the northern part of the state and thousands of people were displaced from their homes, hundreds killed. A lot of people started to flee then into Bangladesh and take to the boats. And this exodus has been ongoing through the last 3 years. Last year, there were 63,000 who took to the seas. This year, it's already 25,000. A lot of them are making it. But what happened since the 2012 violence is a lot of Rohingya ended up being ghettoized, internment camps, sort of refugee camps, which were essentially jails where they're given assistance, very minimal, hardly any medical care, but are prevented from leaving, prevented from going to get jobs, prevented from taking part in economic activity. A lot of people decide in circumstances like that, they've had enough. It's time to go. This country has nothing to offer me. And so they seek refuge. They take to the seas. Most of them are seeking to go to Malaysia, a predominantly Muslim country where they feel like they would be more welcome. They're paying money to go there and in the process incurring debt, which then allows traffickers to lord over them and basically control them. So you have people who voluntarily set out but end up being enslaved to the traffickers who are moving them towards Malaysia.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the trafficking issue, and we'll get to that in a minute. But let me turn back to Priscilla Clapp. Priscilla, with respect to regularizing the status of the Rohingya, where do things stand? Because in addition to many other ways of solving this problem, would you agree that somehow reintegrating the Rohingya in Burmese society, providing citizenship, or do you think that this anti-Muslim sentiment on behalf of the Rakhine and Bama, the dominant ethnic group, do you think that that is just never going to change? I mean, do you see a potential, you know, change within Burmese society on the one hand, in addition to other factors that we need to discuss?
Yes, I believe that there is a solution here within Burma itself. And there are people actually working on it. They don't make it into the news. The
exactly.
News only focuses on the negative parts of it. But there are actually many interfaith groups growing up now. There's quite an educational program going because the Buddhist-Muslim problem is not just limited to the Rakhine state. We've also seen violence in other parts, in some of the main cities of the country. And this has been going on for a long time, too, since the end of the colonial period. In fact, there have been huge expulsions of thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of Indians, and expulsions of Chinese in the other direction. So it's not new. What's new right now is the focus on this one sect, the Rohingya themselves. But at any rate, the problem is that the extremists, and particularly the extreme monks, one in particular, have the loudest voices. And they're always in front of microphones. I've never seen a picture of the monk Warathu without a microphone in his face. They crave attention, and we're giving them a lot of attention, I'm afraid.
Back to you, John Sifton. I mean, you talked about the 2012, the bouts of ethnic cleansing that were precipitated by Rakhine nationalists. Some say about 140,000 of an estimated 1.5 million Rohingyas fled into refugee camps. Are you equally optimistic that a solution can be found within Myanmar, or is this anti-Muslim sentiment whereby extremist monks and other Buddhists simply cannot abide this group among them?
Well, it's hard to be optimistic in the short term because the Burmese government hasn't been particularly active in combating the rise of extremism. They have taken some steps in the short term. They deployed the military in Rakhine in 2012 to keep order when the local forces were actually complicit in violence. But they haven't taken long terms of reconciliation. There are interfaith efforts going on, there are civil society efforts going on, but the government itself, instead of combating the increasing violence and hatred between Buddhists and Muslims, they are actually fanning the flames by allowing legislation to be considered in the Burmese legislature that would create further restrictions on Muslims in Burma. So on the contrary, you know, they're actually inflaming the situation. In the long term, though, with a democratically elected government, it's possible that some of the more hateful voices are outstripped by other more moderate voices and, you know, solutions come into play. Because I think most Burmese citizens realize that the hateful rhetoric that is coming out of extremist monks isn't true. The Rohingya are not some terrorist group. They're not taking over the country. They're not the dangerous thing that these hateful Buddhist voices are making them out to be. And people will suddenly realize that someday. And, you know, the hatred may ebb.
A quick follow-up. What about opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi? She has been accused of not being outspoken enough against the mistreatment of the Rohingya.
It's a valid criticism. She has not been outspoken about this issue. She ought to have been. She had a certain moral authority that she could have wielded but didn't. And she, in fact, has been criticized politely by the Dalai Lama this week for not voicing more concern about the plight of the Rohingya generally, and in particular the crisis that's going on this month.
Why do you think that's the case?
She is a politician now. She's not a human rights activist, and she sees her role as very limited. She's curtailed. She feels as though this will incur political costs to her if she speaks out on behalf of the Rohingya, and that's my prediction.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are John Sifton, he's the Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch, from whom you just heard, and Priscilla Clapp, retired minister counselor in the U.S. Foreign Service, currently a senior advisor to the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Asia Society. We're discussing the plight of the Rohingya migrants and the underlying factors that caused them to flee from Myanmar, also known as Burma. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You may also send us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Nana Ya from Accra, Ghana. Well, back to you, Priscilla Clapp, to talk about other factors that are driving these migrants, both the Rohingya and other Bangladeshi, to take to the seas. You both alluded to human trafficking. What other factors?
But I also have a different perspective on the government than John has just given you, and Aung San Suu Kyi, which I would like to give you.
Okay, you can do that if you can do it briefly.
I have spent a lot of time talking with members of the government because I've been very concerned about the way they're handling this. And they are actually doing things, but they're doing it very quietly because it has become such an election issue that they are all concerned about how it's going to affect the votes for various parties.
The
elections are going to be in November. This is all very new to them, but they're trying to run a real election this time. And the radical monks have already entered it into the election arena as an issue. and they have threatened any party that seems to be sympathetic to Muslims, per se. They've already turned on Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD, and they're going around the country campaigning against them. So it is a very sensitive issue with them.
Is that all you want to say? Because I want to get...
No, I wanted to say some of the things the government is doing. They are actually bringing groups of moderate Rohingya and Rakhine together in Rakhine State to begin a dialogue. They are also beginning to process Rohingya for citizenship, and several thousand of them have already received citizenship.
Quickly, John, before we get into these other factors, do you see some of these under-the-radar activities going on behalf of the government, that they are, in fact, trying to address the problem, but just because the election is coming up, they're trying to do it more quietly? And one more question, too, with respect to Buddhism. Again, I don't know much about it, but whenever one hears or thinks about Buddhism, one thinks of peace, sort of, you know, a very tolerant type of attitude. It's rather shocking for those of us who see it that way to acknowledge that some Buddhist monks are at the forefront of this hateful attitude.
Yeah, well, the first thing to say about that is that a lot of these people are Buddhist in name only. I think a lot of legitimate Buddhists would gripe that some of the monks who spew some of these more hateful attitudes are true Buddhists and follow the teachings of the Buddha. On the issue of the government, I'd admit the government has done things. They called out the army to protect Rohingya at the very beginning of the crisis, and they have taken steps at reconciliation. But if they were serious about really seeking reconciliation, they would have not allowed legislation to be considered in Parliament that would further cause divisiveness by, you know, basically suggesting that the Rohingya are overpopulating, that Muslims are overpopulating, that interfaith marriages have to be curtailed. Would have stopped that legislation, and they would have done more to provide security in the short term at the local level. I don't think that they want this to be a hateful situation, but they are allowing it to foment more than they should. Everybody agrees at this point that they do need to do more.
So back to you, Priscilla Klopp, to talk about these other factors, whether it's demographic, political, economic pressures in Bangladesh, human trafficking. Talk about these other factors that are driving these migrants.
Bangladesh is a major source of these boat migrants. Many of them are men from Bangladesh who are seeking to get to Malaysia, Indonesia, where they perceive opportunities for employment. Bangladesh is a very poor, overpopulated country. And people have been seeking to leave Bangladesh for a long time. And they are taking advantage of the focus on the Rohingya problem to join the crowd exiting. Some of them pretend to be Rohingya, some of them don't. But as they're picking up the boats recently, we're beginning to see how many of them are actually Bangladeshi. The boats that the Burmese Navy picked up recently had mostly Bangladeshi on them. The ones that were Rohingya, they took into Burma, but the others, the Bangladeshis agreed to receive them back.
Well, speaking of Bangladesh, I mean, not only does Myanmar have its work cut out for it internally to try to tamp down the discrimination and improve the lot of the Rohingya, but in Bangladesh, perhaps the economic and political situation too needs to be addressed. And I do take note that the Prime Minister was very denigrating about some of these refugees who were leaving Bangladesh. She didn't have very kind words for them, so I'm not sure if that helps either.
Well, I don't think the political situation in Bangladesh is very good these days.
No,
it's not. It's not a good situation.
How much of a factor do you think that is, John?
Well, Bangladesh's governance situation is absolutely atrocious. I mean, it's a terrible situation. It's led by a one-party state that won an election that wasn't contested, and the prime minister is almost delusional in her delusions of grandeur. So there's not a lot of long-term solutions that can be worked out in the short term in Bangladesh. But I would hesitate to say that the majority of the migrants that are currently on the seas are coming from Bangladesh. A lot of them on the boats that were off Burma were, but down in Indonesia and Malaysia, most of these boats are almost entirely Rohingya. There's a sprinkling of Bangladesh migrants in there, but they're not the majority.
Back to you, Priscilla Klopp, because earlier John Sifton brought up the problem of human traffickers, particularly in Thailand and Malaysia. What is your take on their role in aggravating this crisis?
They're centrally involved. They have an awful lot to do with it, and I think that there should be very serious focus on them. If you can stop the trafficking, you can stop the boat crisis. Their methodology is evil. They are connected into government, and particularly in Thailand and Malaysia. Most of them are Thai and Malaysian. Some are Rohingya. Some of them are Bangladeshi. Some of them are Rakhine. But they're very, very evil people. And they're in it for the money. They will stop at nothing to get it. And we can see from all of the death camps that they're not kind.
Turning back to you, John Sefton, to add or subtract with respect to the role of the human traffickers and to what extent the regional actors, Malaysia, Thailand, will indeed grapple with this dilemma, or to what extent are they, are their governments too weak or corrupt or others in the region to actually take them on because they're complicit?
Thailand and Malaysia have terrible records on trafficking, which is why they're listed as Tier 3, the worst ranking under the State Department ranking system for trafficking. But they can do better. There's no doubt about it. Especially the Malaysian police, who, despite being corrupt, have a capacity to crack down on the traffickers. Thailand does as well. Thailand's own military is complicit in the trafficking. But I don't think the complicity goes all the way up to the top of the military junta. It's local commanders, local officers who are on the take. Those people can be disciplined, they can be pulled out of their posts. And the mafia, basically, in Thailand, the criminal cartels that control the trafficking routes, can be cracked down and put in jail. And that'll go a long way towards alleviating the crisis. But at the same time, people are going to continue to flee. And that's where it comes into play, the question of what to do about the people who do end up arriving in Indonesia or Malaysia or stop in Thailand on the way to Malaysia. What are you going to do with them? They can't be sent back if they are valid asylum seekers. They need to be resettled either in Malaysia or somewhere else. So the deal right now is that all the countries have to get together and decide how to share that burden.
We note that an agreement has been hammered out by Malaysia, Thailand, and Indonesia, but that, again, they won't host the refugees permanently. Talk about the role of Indonesia. Has it been a positive one?
We don't look at the governments to do this. It's the UN. It's the UN High Commissioner of Refugees, International Organization for Migration, because they can overarch the problems that governments have receiving refugees. And if you set up the camps under the umbrella of the UNHCR and IOM, then the local governments don't have the responsibility for either receiving or resettling them. We had millions of refugees from Vietnam years ago. Other people in this room are too young to remember that, but I remember it well. We had a huge Chinese migration in the 90s. They were coming out in ships with 500 and more people on them. Same sort of thing, traffickers. Lots of money, even more money in those cases, and they were trying to get them to the U.S.
What is the U.N. Refugee Agency doing right now? I understand that they are being slow to classify the Rohingya in particular as refugees.
You don't classify groups as refugees until you have done refugee dossiers on them. That never happens. They can be treated as people in need of humanitarian assistance. But whether they're refugees, immigrants, or whatever these legal standards are, is only determined after you actually sit down with the person and see what their background is.
All right. And what are you saying with respect to that, John Sifton?
UNHCR is doing a lot. They've made proposals for action on what's going to happen in terms of burden sharing, but they will ultimately need to get in there to wherever the people are brought to shore and carry out refugee status determinations, find out who's a refugee, who's not, who's a migrant, and what, and then facilitate the resettlement. But that's only going to happen if the countries let them do it. And I'm confident that that's going to happen, but it's a big process.
With Vietnam, they did.
Yeah, Priscilla is absolutely right. I mean, this has been done before, and the numbers were far, far higher. The crisis in the Mediterranean, the crisis with Vietnamese boat people in decades past were much bigger than this one is. So this is, while a big crisis, is hardly the biggest crisis that they've ever dealt with boat people.
All right. Well, certainly, as the U.S. Institute of Peace report mentioned, written by Priscilla Klapper, it's going to be a multi-pronged approach, both short and long term, to solve this crisis. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Sifton, he's the Asia Advocacy Director at Human Rights Watch, and Priscilla Klapp, retired minister counselor in the U.S. Foreign Service, currently a senior advisor to the U.S. Institute of Peace and the Asia Society. Thanks so much to both of you for sharing your terrific insights.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Carl Starling, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.